BRB 114, the Jazz Studio, where tradition meets technology.
Welcome to the Jazz Studio. I'm Gary Motley. My guests today are Robert Spano, director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and artist in residence, and Dwight Andrews, associate professor of jazz studies and composition. One of the things I've noticed, Robert, that you're premiering works that incorporate different things from jazz to world music. What are some of the challenges you face in terms of realizing those things with your orchestra?
Well, personally, the challenge is I have to learn the new language. And the great thing is in most cases, I'm doing this with living composers so I can get them on the phone, which is, you know, I have trouble with the dead ones. Yeah. They don't return my calls. Yeah. But that is, even being able to talk with them, it's still a challenge. And I still am, even composers I know really well, they'll bring something to me and I think I know what's going on and I'll do it. And they'll say, no, I'm looking for something else. And I don't mind, I welcome that. My role is to try and understand the composer's intent and realize it as best I can. To the extent that I appear in that mix, I think happens naturally. There's something about any creative endeavor that without effort, you're there. You know, right. you're part of the mix without even trying. So I don't worry mm-hmm. about that. I worry about how do I best understand what the composer was hearing and what they wanted. And often I'm being asked to learn things I just didn't know. The first time I did Osvaldo's Passion, there's this Cuban drumming group in front of me mm-hmm. who improvises constantly, who's replaced a continuo group. Now I don't have a harpsichord and a bass and a cello. I've got Cuban drummers and I don't know what they're doing. So I had to learn what they were doing and how to listen to it, because essentially I didn't conduct them. I conduct the chorus and make sure the chorus is hooked into them. I just go with them because they're the percussion. Mm-hmm. They're the time.
Yeah, the heartbeat.
And it's an irregular heartbeat, so I had to figure out how to hear them, especially because of the complexity of their improvisation. When I finally started to get it, I got very excited because it took me a while.
Sure.
And it took a number of rehearsals before, I know what you're up to. You know, and then it was a revelatory moment for me. So that's a personal challenge. And then there's the practical challenges of now we've got in another work we just did, we've got a Persian fiddle on stage. We've got a laptop performer, you know, who's riffing with the laptop in the moment, and an electric hyper accordion.
Wow.
And that's just not what we're used to when we're playing Beethoven. Mm-hmm. So there's that practical challenge of miking it and acoustically managing it. And how does the orchestra hear that? And how do you balance it? How do you integrate it? So it's sort of both sides of the coin are real learning curves, and I find to be a very exciting way because then you end up somewhere you couldn't have imagined once you take the trip.
Are you the exception to the rule in the sense that are many of the conductors in American orchestras, for example, really exploring in the way that you are, or are you really the exception? Because it seems to me you're part of the future of orchestras in America because you're kind of opening the door. And I'm just wondering, I don't get a chance to talk with the maestros all the time. Mm. So is this a common conversation you have with other conductors? Is that fair, or are you really the exception?
I'm not an exception, but I'm also not the norm. Mm. And I think this is true. It's somewhat generational. Because when I think about the colleagues I have who are my age, they're doing it in some way of their own, mm-hmm. not necessarily the way we do it here in Atlanta, but they have their own version. Like Alan Gilbert in New York, mm-hmm. you know, he has that whole new music initiative. He has these people coming in from all over. He's got composers around. In his first season, he was presenting Ligeti's Grand Macabre, which has never been done in New York. You know, so there's a whole push on his part to open it up. And maybe I'm just thinking of these guys because we all went to Curtis. Mm-hmm. And Michael Stern in Kansas mm-hmm. City, he's doing a lot of commissioning. He's finding new young voices among composers. Have gotten aware of a new composer that we're going to be working with here, Adam Schoenberg. I think it's so wonderful his name is Schoenberg. Mm. You know, it's like we're going to fix
and
that
no
problem. No relation. No, actually, he's related to Gershwin.
Is that right?
Yeah, so he's the real antidote. but he came to my attention largely because of Michael. On the other hand, Michael Tilson Thomas, who's, what, 10, 15 years older than me, mm-hmm. he's already been doing it for a lifetime, and in San Francisco he's doing a lot. And Esa-Pekka Salonen, who's maybe 10 years older than I am, he's been doing a lot in L.A. So there is a world of us mm-hmm. who are interested in this expansion attitude about musical language and what an orchestra can do and be. And then there are the traditionalists, and they're certainly around too. And they might engage new music at different times and in different ways, but they're more interested in the core of the tradition. And, you know, Muti's going to Chicago. He certainly represents that. Mazel, who preceded Allen in New York, certainly represents, even though he's a composer himself. Mm-hmm. In fact, in terms of his programming and his musical taste and the way it was reflected, was more of a core and traditional approach. So, yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag, I guess, is the real answer. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's often said that art reflects the environment from which it emerges. And when we start looking at where we are now in terms of the tradition and then introducing new things, how do we find a balance between those two? And what direction do you think we're headed in? Because certainly right now, I think we're forging new ground. And how do we do that responsibly and while remaining kind of true to our traditionalists, but at the same time opening up and introducing this to a new audience?
It's a great question, and, mm-hmm. and not one that's easily answered, because when I look back over my own training and career, I always think that, gosh, if I had just known more about jazz as a young clarinetist, but in those days you couldn't study jazz and be a conservatory clarinetist because, you know, the thought was that it would destroy your sensibilities for playing in an orchestra. So on one level, part of me wants to broaden the educational experience of all of our musicians and future audiences. But at the very same time, I acknowledge that each one of these worlds has a great demand to it. And so you don't want to give any of it short shrift. So, for example, as a theory teacher, I'm always concerned about these theory books that kind of have an addendum that says popular music in America. And then all in one chapter, you get everything from Gershwin, Copeland to Little Wayne. And so It's not careful enough to my way of thinking. So I guess what I would bring back, if I could, would be a way of thinking about the preparation. So that, for example, your very idea about improvisation, if we could bring improvisation into the very beginning of a student's experience in music, so that they would understand that there isn't that much difference between Bach and Benny Goodman, because it is note to note, note against note, right, in terms of improvising. And so if we built in improvising and listening, the level of ear training in a different way, so that you would have just a broader sense of hearing, I think that would change ultimately the end result, rather than trying to make it, you know, learn all of these various styles. It's what we're learning, I think, that I'm most interested in.
That makes so much sense to me. And while you were saying that, I was thinking, I love your Bach-Benny Goodman comparison, because Bach in his own lifetime wasn't widely regarded as a composer. He was outmoded and boring mm-hmm. In the opinion of many people, but he was still widely regarded as an improviser. Right. He had a great reputation as an improviser.
Exactly.
So our assessment of him has changed, but the fact was that the core of his art was improvisation. And improvisation does open up so that it's not a matter of everybody learning every language. It's everybody having the capacity to be flexible enough to learn any language
yes.
that attracts them.
Yes.
I'm in tune with what you're saying,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I love that, because in my mind, the nuclear explosion that happened in music happened before the bomb, and it was recorded music. Mm-hmm. And it's continued, the mushroom continues, because now it's the internet. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's so hard, I think, in our imaginations to picture a world where if you wanted to hear it, you got there.
Right.
And in Bach's case, on foot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You walked 300 miles to hear Buxtehude. Mm-hmm. That's a very different thing than I'm going to press this button and I can hear Shakuhachi in Tokyo right now. I mean, that to me, that's mind-blowing. Yeah. And you see what happens musically. You were talking about Debussy and Stravinsky revolutionizing the orchestra earlier. Mm-hmm. And Debussy heard Gamelan at the World Expo in Paris at, what was it, 1896, yeah, something like that. My date's probably wrong, but I'm close enough. Mm-hmm. It's end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. That created a revolution in his music when he heard Gamelan. So imagine that world and then realize how different our world is and what that's done to our music making, which I think is just open it up. And what's happened is then you've got these cross-fertilized musics, like Steve Reich combining Hebrew chant and African drumming and Tehillim. You've got all these Chinese-American composers taking traditional Chinese music, and they've all been trained in Western symphonic music. So they've got this whole hybrid going on, Tan Dun and Bright Shang and Zhou Long. Mm-hmm. You've got Osvaldo Golioff using Sephardic stuff and Cuban drumming and flamenco and putting it in the same goulash. There's this kind of meltdown of discrete musical languages that makes us, I think, not know where we are at the moment. And to me, one of the exciting things is, if you were writing music in Vienna in 1770, you knew what language you were speaking. Mm-hmm. And now, you can speak any language you like or any combination thereof, because ultimately, however much the metaphor is good for music as a language, it's not the same as verbal language. It's more flexible. Right. There's more connectivity.
Yeah. Sure. Sure, and a greater degree of expression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
For me, it's like the most exciting time possible to be a musician, because it's all been blown up.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your observations and your insight, and also thank you very much for the work that you continue to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to talk with
you. It's been great. We have to do some more of this.
I agree.
My guest today, Robert Spano, director of the Atlanta Symphony and artist in residence, and Dwight Andrews, professor of jazz studies and composition. I'm Gary Motley, and this is The Jazz Studio.
BRB 114, The Jazz Studio, where tradition meets technology.